Well, in the years I was an English teacher, I spent a lot of time and effort showing my students everything they were doing wrong, which was a lot. I had learned to teach and grade writing, in particular, from some old school English teachers. And the basic method was to get kids writing a lot and then to mark up everything that they would do wrong and hope they would like pay attention and try harder and do better next time. This was discouraging for me. I spent a lot of time marking up papers. There was usually, again, lots that was wrong. And this method didn't work. Like paper after paper, students seemed to have the same problems over and over again, the same ones I had just corrected. I was thinking, like, this can't be great for my students either, because they'd turn their work into me and they'd get it covered in this sea of red, like letting them know all the ways they had failed again. I thought, wow, how demoralizing to be them. I tried different things to make it less of a drag. Like I'd heard that like red and green and purple pen looked like more gentle, less harsh than red. So I tried doing the same thing in different pen colors. I tried to get students correcting each other's work, so at least like I wouldn't have to have the pain of doing that. I tried scheduling like one-on-one oral writing conferences with my students so I could talk to them about what they were doing wrong instead of writing it down, like while the rest of the class supposedly engaged in constructive, independent work, but more often than not like devolved into chaos. But none of this was bringing a breakthrough for my students in how they or I experienced the writing process together. Until one year, I got an idea, and it was from the mouth of Jesus, like quite literally. Every year at about this time, my school had a two-day retreat for the faculty to get to know each other and do some planning for the year ahead. It was usually held in a rural spot a bit northwest of here out on Route 2. And when I could, I liked to ride my bike out there instead of driving, get some time by myself. In this particular year, I stopped at Walden Pond on the way to take a swim and to spend a little time in prayer for the year ahead. It had been a habit of mine in the years when I was a teacher and then a principal to spend like a day or a half day right about this time of year doing some reflection and praying about my work as an educator. And this year I was there doing that at Walden Pond, and I was reading parts of the Gospel of John to help direct my prayers. And these words from Jesus jumped out at me, and they really changed the way I taught writing and just about everything else. These were the words, one line. God didn't send his Son into the world to judge the world, but that the world might be saved through him. And I thought, what am I doing as a teacher? Am I here to judge them or to save them? Now, I could wiggle out of these words because really neither of those things were my job. Those are both like God things, not person things to do. But that's not where my mind went that day alongside the pond. I was struck hard by this question. In my teaching and in my assessment and teaching of writing in particular, was I an agent of judgment or of salvation? Was my work to hold up a standard of excellence for my students, to point out as often as I could the many ways they continually fell short in hopes they'd be motivated and skilled enough to like make that mark eventually? That sounds like judgment. Or was my work to come alongside my students and say and do the things that would have the most likelihood of improving their lives, motivating them to engage in their education, developing, growing, improving skills and confidence and inclination to try more and try harder? None of those things are the difference between like knowing God or not in this life or the next, but they are a type of salvation. My students who did well and who grew their skills and their confidence in school were much more likely to finish high school. They were much less likely to end up incarcerated or impoverished. They were more likely to have lots greater opportunities in their late teen and 20-something years. So the stakes were really real in the work. It was my job to be an effective part of moving life forward for them, or primarily to hold up and enforce the standards. Now, if this was a room full of English teachers or educators, period, and I know some of you are, but if it were a room full of us, I'd go in a lot more detail on this about like educational philosophy and assessment practice and writing pedagogy and why the standards themselves are by no means the problem. All that stuff's really interesting to me, but a few of you are like glazing over already. Like, that is not interesting to everyone here. I'm also going to say that I'm simplifying the story a little bit today to say Jesus told me how to teach writing, because we don't know the words that I read, if they were Jesus' words himself or if they were the writer John's words, because quotation marks had not been invented yet, speaking of teaching of writing, so we don't always know who's saying what in these Gospels. I also was reading like a fair bit about assessment practice and about teaching writing that was influencing my thinking that day, I'm sure. But that day, reading those words of Jesus I just read to you on my way back to school and praying about my work, it struck me with force that I had this opportunity. In my heart, it kind of felt like I had this obligation to move from being more of an agent of judgment to an agent of salvation. I remember telling Jesus, like, I'd like to figure that out. Like, count me in on that work. I want to be on team salvation. For me as a writing teacher, this meant a lot of things. So for instance, it meant I was going to use my pen to notice and point out the strength and possibility in my students' thinking and writing. It was really hard sometimes. I got lots of what I consider to be lousy papers. Like, I had to kind of search for the good sometimes. But I said, I'm going to try every single time I see a piece of writing to kind of point out and articulate the good I see there. I also decided I was going to limit my critical feedback to one or two issues or themes that my students could actually, like, think about and constructively work on, as opposed to, like, 100 criticisms. I was going to avoid the overwhelming judgment of the sea of corrections, and I was going to focus on one or two actionable ways they could really improve. There were a lot of other things I started to do differently in my teaching to show students I was for their success, to show them, or at least pretend, that I liked them. To encourage and motivate them to, like, be their best and do their best. And wouldn't you know it, I started getting some really, really good results. I think what this came down to for me is I was beginning to learn how to love in public. We think and talk and sing about private love all the time. The love in a marriage or in a romance, the love between friends, the love among family. All sweet and important in life, but we can learn to love in public as well. And I think actually whether we learn to practice public love together makes an enormous difference in the kind of workplaces and schools and communities we live in. And learning to practice and receive public love together is our best way to participate in God's work on this earth that, amongst other things, we could call salvation. Today, again, is a back-to-school day at Reservoir, so I want to ask you all for a minute, regardless of your age, to think for a minute about your experience in school, if you had one, which is going to be almost everyone here. If you're still a student, you can think about your first day of school if you already had it this past week or recently. What was that first day of school like? If you're a student and haven't had a first day of school, but you're about to have one, some of the thumb down from kids I got in the room, I think you're in this group. Like, if you're going to have your first day of school, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, think about last spring. What was school like at the end of last year? If you are long out of school or in school but not as a student, like, think back to your childhood. And what are some of the first memories that come to mind when you think, what was school like for me? Are your school memories primarily marked by love and kindness, or by criticism and judgment? What comes to mind as you think about your experience of school? Most of us have a mix of these things. I certainly do. A mix of love and kindness kind of experiences, a mix of criticism and judgment experiences. But I know that a lot of the time, our experiences of criticism and judgment in all of life, and especially in our school years, they hit us really hard and they impact us a lot. Most of us who think, I am not creative. I can't draw or sing or write or speak or do math or any of these things a lot of us say we can't do. We were first taught we can't do those things in school. Our peers or some teacher came alongside us and one way or another showed us or told us, like, overtly, you can't do that thing. And we held on to that belief for the rest of our life. Most kids who don't like school or who have frustrations in school, that kind of pattern of disengaging or not liking school sets in by fourth grade. And then we've got 8 more years, or 12 more years, for those frustrations to continue during some of the most formative years of our lives. even those of us in this room who did really well in school, like we were the kid that all the teachers loved and praised, things went really well for us, even those of us who shined and thrived, or who are shining and thriving right now as stars in your school, we can remember plenty of experiences of humiliation or of injustice, like where we felt like we weren't treated right. Unkind and critical things said and done by our peers or by the adults who had so much power in our lives. Or maybe we escape that, but we remember our friends and our siblings who got a lot of that and the lack of love and kindness that they got in school. School can be really tough, but there are people trying to do really interesting things about this. I heard, for instance, an interview on a podcast called On Being with a neuroscientist named Richard Davidson. And Davidson's done a lot of work in this really important kind of brain and neuroscience discovery called neuroplasticity. It's one of the great insights of our lifetimes, if I understand it correctly, showing us that the brain doesn't harden into like fixed form by the time we're adults, like fixed capacity once our youth is over, but that our brains, like how we learn, how we feel, how we think, how we experience life, how we process and engage with the world, our brains continue to change and grow and develop in our adult lives. And actually, we can shape how our brains develop and adapt, even as adults. And Davidson has been interviewed about this neuroplasticity stuff, I can't say that word, but also about other things in this back-to-school forum in a California school district. And the forum was called Love, Kindness, and Education. And he was saying that love and kindness don't just boost morale in schools. They do that. They make schools happier places to be. But he said, oh, they do a lot more than that. Atmospheres of love and kindness boost our brain's power to learn and perform. Environments of higher judgment, discipline, and stress actually impede learning. But schools where love and kindness and mindfulness, too, are taught are able to improve learning and performance and creativity and lots more. Environments of love and kindness in schools create this a kind of safety that help us even better regulate our attention and engagement, like help it make it easier for us to choose to kind of check in and do well. So this groundbreaking neuroscientist, Richard Davidson, he's involved, he's kind of making at the heart of his career, these programs that teach mindfulness and that try to teach and increase cultures of love and kindness in public schools. I was so lucky when I entered the classroom as a teacher. I was in a new startup school that was really chaotic, that had all kinds of problems, but that was really committed to trying to create an environment of love and kindness for our students and our faculty, too, in our school. While I was struggling a lot in my first year as a teacher, a colleague told me, Steve, you have got to start by liking your students, or like communicating to them, showing them that you like them, regardless of how you feel. He said, if your students know that you like them, they will do whatever you want them to. He said, this is really essential to your success. And then a couple years later, there was Jesus meeting me at Walden Pond through his words in the scripture in the Gospel of John, asking me if I wanted to judge my students or save them. I'm trying to call us to something today that I think is decidedly uncommon. Love and kindness are not the like dominant currency of our public life. Our schools can be, in their own way, uniquely oppressive in how often people are graded and ranked and diminished. Our schools, whether it be like for young children all the way up through our academies in the city, are really good at grading, evaluating, and ranking people and often diminishing some segment of the group of people that are there. But the grading and ranking and diminishing of people are kind of central to lots of the ways we do life in public in our times, whether it be like our workplaces, our social media experiences, our reality TV shows, our politics, our policies, like everywhere you go. Try renting an apartment in the city. Some of you have tried doing that, put a lot of time into that this year. It takes so much time. The process is so stressful, and all throughout there are people that take advantage of us in different ways, and the rent and the mortgages that we pay in our city, they eat up our incomes, they push us toward debt, towards all kinds of stress. This is not like a pro or anti-landlord or capitalism moment. I don't actually really understand economics at all. I have no way to weigh in on that. But our economy also does not naturally produce experiences and cultures of love and kindness for us all. Our politics certainly don't, right? With our president very much leading the charge on this, but by no means alone, a lot of us kind of put myself and my kind first in all our kind of political policies and language. Very little love and kindness for the other. Very little consistent concern practice for the long-term greater good. We live in a, you know, maybe everyone's always said this, but we find in our own way, we live in a uniquely unkind, impatient, irritable age. But our fixation on like me and mine in our public life, our constant grading and ranking and diminishing of people, our inability to make our institutions places of love and kindness, this like, we kind of know in our guts, this is antithetical to the world the way it's supposed to be. And this world as it is provides an amazing opportunity to practice this good news of Jesus about love and kindness. I'm going to hear these words for a minute from one of Jesus' first century followers. They say, love is patient. Love is kind. It isn't jealous. It doesn't brag. It isn't arrogant. It isn't rude. It doesn't seek its own advantage. It isn't irritable. It doesn't keep a record of complaints. It isn't happy with injustice, but is happy with the truth. Love puts up with all things, trusts in all things, hopes for all things, endures all things. That's beautiful poetry. If you hear or read or have heard or read this passage from the Bible, it's most likely been at a wedding, which is great. You could do a lot worse in a marriage than be shaped by humble, gentle, trusting, patient love. A lot of us are still working on that. We chuckle a bit as we hear these words. I'd read this passage at a wedding any day. But in the context of the letter in which these words were written, they were not about weddings or marriages or romantic life or anything private at all. These words were written very much in the context of public life. In this case, they are written to a church congregation trying to practice life together, a church where people really didn't get along, where rich were favored over poor, where kind of showy, impressive spirituality mattered more than love and kindness and unity, where integrity seemed rare and like kind of public moral hypocrisy, really rampant. These words were written to people together, trying to do a public life together to encourage them to learn and practice love in public life. As a pastor of a church, I'm really moved when people learn to love well in private. And I think in my job as a pastor, I hear a few more stories about that than the average person, and they're totally inspiring. When I meet with individuals and with couples, and I see people practicing like love and kindness and gentleness with yourselves, like the way you are believing God sees you, like that's very moving and encouraging. When I listen to or see couples practicing this kind of love and gentleness and kindness in their relationship with one another, that also makes me feel really good. It's wonderful to see. But there's something particularly uniquely inspiring when I see you being people of profound love in your public lives. I remember this year talking to one of you that owns a business that was booming. But what you were really excited about wasn't the profits that you were going to make or the praise that you were getting, although I'm sure that felt good. But what you were really excited to talk about was the happiness and the opportunity you were creating in the lives of your employees. This kind of generous opportunity creation is love in public. And it's fun to see one of you so excited about making that happen. Well, there was another time when I got to see one of you working to change racial injustice in school discipline, to implement like policies and procedures and practices that would ensure that your race didn't have an impact on whether you were suspended or experienced any other kind of discipline in school. That kind of justice is also love in public. It's awesome to see you doing that work. There's a time when another one of you tried to convince the public that the homeless opioid users we encounter on some streets aren't like a scourge we need to get rid of, but are our neighbors that we're invited to befriend and protect and serve. That promotion of kindness is love in public. Or taking it out of like particular jobs or public work we do, there are just so many times when I find out or see that one of you in your apartment building or in your circle of moms or at your job is known as like the most trustworthy of friends, or the kindest in disposition, or the most helpful and generous of neighbors. That too is love in public. And this, I think, is the good news of Jesus made real and embodied and present to our world and public life, not to judge, but to save. I'm trying to say kind of two things at once today, and so I want to like name those and tease them out a little bit for a second. I'm saying that in my life, Jesus inspired me to practice more love and kindness in my classroom, in my work at the time, and that Jesus calls us all to public love and kindness, to help our communities where we live, the industries in which we work, the public rhetoric we're part of, whether it be in our social media feeds or out in our democracy, to help all of that be kinder and more loving. And I'm going to come back to that again, because I think that's like a really important opportunity we all have in our public lives. I'm also saying, though, that each of us deserves environments of love and kindness in which we can grow and flourish. Every one of you deserves a neighborhood and a government and a school if you're part of one and a workplace if you're working, where persistent love and kindness are practiced as the norm for everyone there. But I know most of us are not getting what we deserve. You too get ranked or diminished. You get coldness or outright discrimination or experience of unfairness or injustice or just difficulty in your many spheres of public life. So what do you do when you don't get the public love and kindness that you need and that, frankly, that you deserve? Sometimes you get to walk away. I've followed the story this year of this academic, kind of public theologian that I know kind of tangentially named Christina Cleveland. And she was trying to do her work in an environment she found to be persistently racist and discriminatory and diminishing of her personhood and her contribution. And even though it was a really prestigious environment, she quit. She decided she would take her game elsewhere. And in her explanation, she quoted the really great soul singer Nina Simone, who's saying, "You've got to learn to leave the table when love's no longer being served." That was really great for me to read. Think about, like, well, when love is no longer being served at our tables, sometimes we can't do anything about it. And sometimes we're called to get up and find a different table. That is okay to do. Sometimes we've got choices in which family and friends we're going to spend a lot of time and energy around. Sometimes we have choices about the companies that we work in or the divisions that we work in. And sometimes we have to leave environments where love and kindness aren't being and maybe never will be served. But obviously, a lot of other times, we can't or won't want to leave. Many of you can't leave or don't want to leave your jobs, despite the way, like, there's maybe persistent lack of love and kindness in those environments. Students, most of you don't get to leave your schools if you don't like them, particularly if you're younger. Like, you don't have a choice where you go. You're just there, whether it's loving and kind toward you or not. Many of you live in neighborhoods or work in industries where you can try, but you don't always get to make it an environment of public kindness and love. Which I think is why that's why it's really important that we get to tell ourselves in some way on the regular that we are worthy of love and kindness, and we can be part of community and relationships where we get the prayers and blessings of a faith community that tells us, too, that we are worthy of love and kindness. I have a friend who's been diminished a lot. It happens quickly for her, like just when people see her because of her appearance. She's particularly like gender nonconforming, and she's confronted with a lot of diminishment as a result of that. So she likes to wear this shirt out in public that says, "I am the image of God." I love that. Like, good on her for wearing that shirt, right? Saying that to herself and the world. I spent a day in prayer before every school year when that was my work. Like, not just to be ready to love more or to do good work and reflect on that, but to remember I was not alone, that God was going to be with me in the classroom like every single day this year. Every week here at Reservoir, we try to tell you in different ways that God made you, God loves you, God, like, not just on general terms, but like specifically and uniquely treasures you and delights in you. And if you stick around this community and continue to be engaged, I think and hope you'll find people communicating that to you in their own language and ways as well. I'm going to recommend a particular spiritual practice in just a moment, too, to ground yourself in God's love and kindness for you each day. And then during our third song, After I Speak, where we practice our little meal we call communion, where we try to connect with how God is with us, some of our pastors are going to stand with me, and we're going to say prayers for our educators and our students in the room. So on this back-to-school weekend, those of you in particular that are students or educators, whether or not you'd like to participate in communion or not, we'll have the communion service kind of by the front of the stage here. And right behind, there'll be myself and a couple other pastors to my left and right, ready to say like a really short prayer of blessing for your school year, that you would know God's love and kindness and help in your life as a student or as an educator. And we'll have these little rocks, or these little like memories of the moment. They're these kind of smooth rocks. They say things like my rock says love, or they say other things like that, like hope or blessed or whatever, like something you could carry with you, like literally in your pocket, or just stick somewhere you'll see it, to kind of remember that God is with you. God is with you for your love and your kindness, for your good. And so if you're a student of any age or an educator, we'd love to just offer you that small gift and memory today, later. So I'd love for you to participate. I think this stuff really matters, like not just for those of us in schools. I think it really matters for your flourishing, that you welcome love and kindness for yourself into your imagination, no matter sweet or no matter how hard the public environments you spend time in are. And I think it really matters, too, that we be people who practice love and kindness in public as well. I'm going to read one last scripture before I close from another one of the Bible's letters. It says, "Dear friends, let's love each other, because love is from God, and everyone who loves is born from God and knows God." I'm going to read that sentence again. A friend of mine said about 1 John, it's really hard to read it because it's all so true. It's like there's like a lot of really true and shocking things in each little phrase. I'm going to read that line again and then continue. "Dear friends, let's love each other, because love is from God, and everyone who loves is born from God and knows God. The person who doesn't love does not know God, because God is love. That is how the love of God is revealed to us. God has sent his only Son into the world so that we can live through him. This is love. It is not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as the sacrifice that deals with our sins. Dear friends, if God loved us this way, we also ought to love each other. No one has ever seen God. But if we love each other, God remains in us, and his love is made perfect in us." So there's a lot there on those few short lines, but I think these words tell us that the clearest picture we will ever see of God is in the person of Jesus, laying down his life for his friends, you and I included. Because the very nature of God is love. God doesn't like act loving for whatever strategic reasons God might have. God doesn't try to love as if God had like other choices to make. God is love. Patience, kindness, generosity, self-giving, way-making love is like the essence of who and what God is. And so we're told like one of the most surefire ways to be close to God, to experience God as close to us, to be fully alive in the world, is to practice love, to love others, including love in public. 1 John goes even further than this and says, learning to love others is really the only way that we can be close to God, to see God. And anyone who isn't doing this doesn't know a thing about God or really about anything else that matters. In my last gig in education, I came into the work talking about love in public. I was apparently the only one in that particular principal candidacy pool who had like structured my whole principal certification portfolio around this idea of public love. It was kind of an unusual choice, but it was the one that I made. And I talked about a vision of public love in all of my interviews. And I was told later by my secular Jewish boss that this is part of why she hired me. She said, it's very intriguing that you talked about love in public so much. People don't do that. I want to see what that looks like. Apparently the world is a little hungry for more love and more kindness. But then as I was leaving that job to pastor this church, I kind of wanted people to actually talk about how great I was. What I really wanted in my heart of hearts as I was leaving that job was like to get accolades. So, like, I had been this excellent principal. I wanted to be ranked and graded, right? And I wanted to be ranked and graded highly. I wanted people to praise my achievements. And I think I did some good work there, but mainly that's not what happened. I wasn't there long enough for that. I had fans and serious detractors of my work, too. But at least some people had something far more important to say. And that wasn't necessarily what I wanted to hear. One teacher stopped by my office the last day and said, Steve, I've been thinking about the past few years, and I think our school got a little more kind during the time you were here. I said, that's exactly what we needed. That is not the feedback I was looking for, but that kind of broke my heart open. It was like a different kind of pride I felt hearing that. I've heard one of you say this about the Reservoir community too, that unlike most communities you've been a part of, religious or not, that everything you hear and experience in this community is kindness. Like there's nothing that isn't kind. That moves me to hear that as well. Because whether or not that's always true of us, and I know that is certainly not always true of me, that certainly is true of God. That God is always full of love and kindness. There's a Hebrew word that means loving kindness, which is like the favorite thing people have to say about God in the Bible. And I think, oh, that can be our highest aspiration in our world as well, to be people of love and kindness, who make cultures and institutions of love and kindness as well. And so I'd invite you to hear, kind of take into your imagination a couple closing invitations in this regard. My first invitation is to invite you in your own way to learn to practice love in public. All right, whether your public life is mainly as a volunteer or an employee or parts of circles of parents or in the neighborhood you live in or in anything else that you interact with in the public world. By practicing love in that sphere, this will make you a powerful, saving force, whether it be in your job or your community. And it will also bring you into consistent experiences of the closeness of God to you. And I want to invite you in just like a particular spiritual practice, this day, this week, this year, if it works for you, to early in the day, each day this week, tell yourself, God loves me all the time. There is no part of me to which God is not loving and kind. God is loving and kind, not just to me in general, but to every part of me. And say to God and yourself in your own way, like, I want to practice love and kindness today in all that I do. None of us have that like natural disposition or the kind of power or motivation to do that consistently, but we can state our intention each day to ourselves and to God and to see what clarity, what power that brings. I'm going to pray for us all now. I'm going to invite you again, like as we, as the band comes back and as we move through service, when Ivy leads in communion, she'll invite us as well. But students, educators, whether or not you want to participate in communion, although everyone in this room will be invited to do that, we'll certainly invite you to, after you take communion or to kind of just walk around the communion stations and receive a quick prayer and blessing from one of our pastors. We'd love to encourage you as your year gets started. Why don't you pray with me for a moment? Thanks, Chris.